This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
A big bank downgrade.
Does that mean a big bank bailout? Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. It is Friday, June 22nd. And coming up, we've got a lot about this big Moody's downgrade of 15 of the world's largest banks and what that means for the economy.
And on a little bit lighter note, I suppose, I've been wondering, like, what's up for Miami if the team stinks next year? Which, you never know, the magic could evaporate.
And could happen.
Also, we're going to talk about honesty, insider trading, and Greek tax paying. How do we get those dang Greeks to be a little more honest and pay their taxes? It's coming up in a moment.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
After U.S. markets closed yesterday, came another one of those dreaded moments for the world's largest banks.
That's right. The credit rating agency Moody's slashed the ratings of 15 of the world's biggest financial institutions, including the big guys here in the U.S., Citigroup, Bank of America, and Barclays and Credit Suisse, among others, in Europe. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more now from London.
15 titans of the financial world have been humbled. Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, UBS, and Deutsche Bank among them. They've had their credit ratings cut by between 1 and 3 notches. This will make it more expensive for them to borrow. Moody's says these 15 banks have been downgraded because they're all heavily involved in financial markets. They risk big losses as these markets have become more volatile. Ralph Silver of SRN Consulting says these markets are volatile because the global economy looks more fragile. He says the downgrades are a vote of no confidence in recovery.
What we're really seeing here is an indication that there is no expectation of an economic recovery between here and the end of the year. As a result, the banks who are directly linked to the economy right now will probably suffer as well.
Some analysts say the downgrades could make matters worse. These banks may now have to beef up their capital, and that will mean lending less to households and businesses. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
And now going a little deeper on the Moody's bank downgrade, when you look at the fine print, it hints at more bank bailouts down the road. Here's our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore.
People only care about banks when they screw up. So let's cut to the chase. Are we going to have to bail these suckers out again? According to Moody's, if another crisis comes, most of the big U.S. banks are likely to get another government bailout. Randy Krosner is a professor of economics at the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago. He says a good credit rating is a sign of a bank's ability to survive.
Having a very high rating is crucial. You want to make sure that the person you're trading with is going to be there down the line.
Moody's concern is that the banks are still suffering from 2008. They could also be hurt by a European crisis and a global financial slowdown.
Some are exposed to more risks than others. The underlying problem is still there.
The Moody's report said Bank of America, Citigroup, and Morgan Stanley have improved since 2008, but not enough. As for J.P. Morgan, which just went through congressional hearings, Moody's doesn't think the government would step in to help them. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
So it's probably an understatement that the world economy could use a little more confidence today. Arguably, it could also use a little more honesty. Dan Ariely is a psychologist and behavioral economist at Duke. He's got a new book out. It's called The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. So we asked him in to talk about a couple items from the news this week. Dan, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Let's talk about insider trading. We have Rajat Gupta, who's facing a long prison term, potentially, for securities fraud. What does your research tell us about why people who are probably making plenty of money already would fall into this trap?
First of all, it turns out that nobody is thinking long term. You know, we think to ourselves that, oh, if there was only a big prison sentence at the end of some bad behavior, people would think about it and therefore not behave this way. The answer is no, mm-hmm. This is not the case. The second thing is that turns out that lots of people do that. And when insider trader, or when, let me say differently, when traders see other people around them participating in insider trading, all of a sudden this doesn't look as bad to them.
So there's an awful lot of rationalization that goes on, I gather.
Rationalization is the key. And with insider trading, you could say to yourself, everybody's doing it. Or you could say, this was actually public information. If I would look hard enough, I would find it. And we find that the more ability to rationalize exists, the more people are dishonest.
One place where a little more honesty could go a long way is Greece. It's common knowledge through all of this now that the Greeks, on the whole, are pretty big tax cheats.
Here is what I think is the story with Greece. I think it's a story of a social agreement about what is okay. For many behaviors, we see what are other people doing. And if it's something that everybody else is doing, then we don't feel bad about it. And I think in the Greek case, everybody's doing it, not just other citizens, but the government has been cooking the book. So because of that, people look at their own taxes and they say, why should I be the only sucker? And therefore, they don't do it.
If you were advising the Greek version of the IRS, what would you prescribe to fix the problem?
So I think what they need is they need amnesty. They need to tell people, okay, from now on, we're getting a new start. And I think a referendum on this regard is so important. And in the experiments, we find that when we give people a chance, there is a much reduction in dishonesty. So I think the Greek people need to adopt something like that. And that's the only way to move forward.
Well, thanks very much for the insight on it. Professor Dan Ariely, the book is The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Keeping things international for a moment, things are slow in the U.S. and Europe, so China is worried about where it's going to find new customers. So it's looking south to South America, and Brazil specifically. In fact, this week, China and Brazil agreed to a landmark deal that avoids using the U.S. dollar. The BBC's Hong Kong correspondent Juliana Liu reports.
Right now, if you're buying a barrel of oil or a pound of coffee on global markets, you pretty much have to pay with the US dollar. China, the world's second largest economy, hopes to change that. It wants its currency, the renminbi, to someday stand alongside the dollar in global markets for things like trade and investment. This agreement with mega trading partner Brazil is another step in that process, says Francis Zheng, a Hong Kong-based senior strategist at the investment bank Crédit Agricole.
It is actually part of the effort to try to internationalize the renminbi to promote the use of it outside China. So I think China is targeting to get the renminbi to be one of the reserve currency, but not to replace the dollar.
Zheng says China will continue to push more deals like this in the next few years, and that eventually, some economists believe the Chinese currency may become a very real competitor. In Hong Kong, I'm the BBC's Juliana Liu for Marketplace.
Now back to the United States and the presidential race. Mitt Romney is going to be in Park City, Utah this weekend hosting an event for some of his biggest donors.
Romney's reportedly on track to raise $100 million this month alone, which could be more than President Obama raises. Marketplace's David Gura reports from Washington.
Here's what you need to know to understand this story.
Romney is doing well with big donors. He's consistently done well with big donors.
Bert Johnson teaches political science at Middlebury College. Romney's got buddies in business, he's a good fundraiser, and so far that's paid off. But Johnson says Romney hasn't been as successful with small donors.
Small donors do indicate a wider base of enthusiasm.
And harnessing that kind of donor helped candidate Obama become President Obama back in 2008. But the dynamics have changed since then. We've got super PACs now. And if 2008 was the year of the small donor, maybe this is the year of the big one. Bob Biersack is with the Center for Responsive Politics. And he says to keep things in perspective.
So we haven't seen big, dramatic numbers for the DNC, perhaps, in every reporting period. But when you add it all together, they've done pretty well.
The way money works in elections is pretty consistent over time, Biersack says. And there's a lot of time left until Election Day. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, I guess we can head into the weekend knowing we've got to wait at least a couple more days for the Supreme Court to weigh in on the healthcare reform.
Yeah, there was that thought that it might come out yesterday, but now it looks like it won't happen until at least next week.
Yeah, around here everybody's on like pins and needles, like this thing could drop any moment. But okay, we'll postpone that feeling until next week. One of the critical elements in the law is guaranteed coverage for people with a pre-existing condition. And before the reforms, those pre-existing conditions could jack up your insurance premiums, maybe keep you from getting insurance altogether. But what exactly counts as a pre-existing condition? We asked Marketplace's Adrian Hill to find out.
I wanted an easy-peasy definition of a pre-existing condition. So I called up Karen Politz at the independent Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation.
And I was wondering if there's a simple definition out there.
Simple. Well, this is health insurance, so not exactly.
And not exactly simple doesn't even come close to how complicated the answer is. The rules vary state by state, company by company, ailment by ailment. But in general, say you want to buy a health insurance policy on your own.
Insurers will look broadly at anything you have now, anything you may have had in the past, even risk factors for something that you may have in the future.
Some of the questions is, are you pregnant or are you expectant father? Do you have any retained hardware?
Tim Peterson is an insurance broker in LA. He walks me through an application. The questions pretty much include everything that can go wrong with your body.
Do you have any ulcers, TMJ, arthritis? If you're actively in therapy, that can be an issue.
Not all these things mean you'll pay more or get denied. That's up to the individual insurer. But Peterson says there are surprises. Take a client who wound up with a toenail fungus after a pedicure and had to take medicine to treat it.
And they got a 25% rate increase for taking a medication for toenail fungus.
As many as half of non-elderly Americans have some kind of pre-existing condition, according to the Department of Health and Human Services. If healthcare reform is upheld by the Supreme Court, those conditions will basically stop mattering in 2014. You can't be denied, and
you would pay the same premium.
Sarah Collins is with the Commonwealth Fund.
Just as if you were working for an employer who offered a health plan, you don't pay more than your colleague because you have diabetes and your colleague doesn't.
But if the Supreme Court decides the act is unconstitutional, everything from cancer to hay fever could continue to count against you. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
So imagine you're sitting down to dinner or you're trying to get some sleep and you hear this. Well, if you live in Los Angeles, that's not your imagination. It's real life, which is where Democratic Congressman Howard Berman comes in. He is trying to change federal... Hang on a second. Let's let him go by. All right. He's trying to change federal law to limit helicopter noise over residential neighborhoods in Southern California. And he joins us now. Mr. Berman, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, you've lived in Southern California, at least part-time, for your whole life. How much worse is the helicopter noise problem now than it used to be?
Substantially. This was not an issue that was noticed for a very long time, but in recent years, and particularly since the Carmageddon weekend, I've been hearing from constituents and noticed myself the frequency of hovering helicopters over people's homes.
And are these mostly news choppers or tourist helicopters or
no,
what?
No, I mean, there's both police and news reporters have used helicopters frequently in the past. The bigger problem is that it has morphed into a form of helicopter tourism, where people who used to take bus tours of star homes now take helicopter tours. Those helicopters fly over celebrity houses, impacting on the entire neighborhood, and there's no law, no regulation, no constraint on their legal right to do that.
So does that mean the people that are complaining to you about this are like Brad Pitt and Tom Hanks and big Hollywood celebrities?
No, they're probably more likely the people who live near Brad Pitt and Tom Hanks.
Okay. A few years ago, I visited Memphis, which is, of course, the home of FedEx, where hundreds of huge planes take off every night over residential areas. And I found it interesting that no one seems to mind there because they know that those planes mean jobs in Memphis. And I wonder, can't you make the same argument for helicopters that are flying tourists around?
Well, we have regulations for air traffic in Los Angeles. If you come in late at night, you land from the Pacific Ocean rather than landing over the residential areas to improve the quality of life for the people who live under air traffic. I'm not trying to prohibit helicopter traffic. I'm just trying to establish some regulatory framework to try and improve quality of life in a way that doesn't impede law enforcement and at the same time provide some relief for my constituents.
Congressman Howard Berman, Democrat of California, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, Jeff, is there anything that you carry with you all the time that would stress you out a lot if you lost it?
Yeah, well, I just got out here to L.A., so I'm going in the pool a lot. And every time I get in, I look at my finger on my left hand, my wedding ring.
Yep.
And if that sucker fell off, it's with me every moment of the day, I would freak.
Well, the wedding ring actually is not number one in a new survey that asked people that. What's the item that you carry around that would stress you out the most? Okay. Turns out 77% said that losing a mobile device would stress them out more than losing a wedding ring.
I'm in the 23% that I think could deal with that.
Yeah, however, it could be that this study is flawed because it was done by the tech company Intel, which probably has a little bit of a stake in people wanting to have mobile devices.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
With his company SpaceX, billionaire entrepreneur Elon Musk recently proved that a private company has the know-how to fly to the International Space Station and back.
But can he get the car company he founded off the ground? Today, Tesla Motors delivers, finally, after talking about it forever, to its customers, its first all-electric sedan. As Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, the company has bet the moon on the success of this car.
Tesla's all-electric sedan is called the Model S. It can travel up to 300 miles before it needs to be recharged. John Odell with Edmunds.com says the new car will make or break the company.
Tesla has never been profitable. They need the sales of this car to push them over that hump and to start bringing in an annual profit so that they can generate funds.
The first version of the Model S is expensive, more than $100,000. Jesse Toprak covers the electric vehicle market for TrueCar.com.
There are only so many cars you can sell to Sierra Club members or celebrities. It certainly is not going to be the top choice of the middle-class families, at least not right now.
Middle-class consumers may be more interested in a cheaper version of the car, expected by winter at about half the price. Tesla didn't respond to an interview request, but the company has proven popular with Wall Street investors. Since Tesla went public 2 years ago, its stock price has doubled. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Are you one of those people who constantly ignores that pop-up message telling you to update your web browser, Jeff?
No, I am not. I update obsessively.
Really? You always say yes when they ask you for an update?
It's only going to ask you again.
No, but it never stops, especially with iTunes. That's what really drives me crazy.
Oh, I don't even use iTunes, but it has to be there. Just yes.
Yeah, constant
bet noir of my
And yet I never notice what the update is. That's the weird part. Well, an online retailer in Australia plans to put a kind of tax on customers who shop using outdated browsers. Here's Stuart Cohen from Sydney.
Australian electronics retailer Kogan.com plans to charge an extra 6.8% to customers who shop on the site using Microsoft's Internet Explorer version 7. Company owner Ruslan Kogan came up with the bizarre number by adding 0.1% for every month since the browser came out 68 months ago. He says it's costing a fortune to keep the site compatible with such old technology.
It takes just as much time to make a page appear properly in Internet Explorer 7 as it does to make it appear in every other browser. So we're doubling up on all our web creativity and web work.
Kogan says he's heard from other businesses who say they may try the same thing.
We've got the resources to code our website in a way that it appears properly in every other browser. But there's a lot of websites out there that haven't even thought about Internet Explorer 7. You know, we're improving the way that the internet works.
Kogan says he doesn't expect many people to actually pay the tax. His site offers links to help customers update their browser and avoid the extra charge. In Sydney, I'm Stuart Cohen for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, we have to wake up at ungodly hours. Did you stay up and watch the NBA Finals last night?
No, I did not. I saw the first maybe 10 minutes of it, and I did not know until I woke up this morning what had happened.
You probably saw all that mattered. I don't think the story changed a lot after that. The Heat won by a lot. Yeah. And this little experiment, I'll call it an experiment, pulling this super team together in Miami all at once has obviously been huge for the city. And you have to presume it's put plenty in the team's pockets, too. But from a strictly business point of view, like, what now, right? So I sure don't have a clue about what's going to happen. So we have Henry Abbott here, who writes the True Hoop blog at ESPN.com. Henry, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh, the supporting cast like Battier. Let's say we're talking a big legacy here. As a business proposition, what does that mean potentially for a city like Miami?
Well, it's a funny thing. The NBA is changing from a sport where the primary revenue driver is ticket sales to national TV deals. And what that means, though, is that for owner Mickey Arison, who has had a bad financial few years, most of his money is in the cruise industry, which hasn't gone very well, they don't get the huge windfall from ticket prices like they would. All that said, the whole industry of owning an NBA team has gotten much better with, you know, players making a much smaller percentage of league revenues with the new collective bargaining agreement. But it doesn't actually mean that there's going to just be fat city like it used to be if your particular team is doing well. There's more revenue sharing now. And ironically, I know that one of the things about winning the NBA championship in particular is it costs millions, I'm told, to buy everybody championship rings. And that actually affects the bottom line.
So let's look at the other outcome here. Let's say next year rolls around. The passion is kind of gone from these guys. Something changes. The magic has disappeared. Is the economic fallout even greater for how high they climbed this year?
In the big picture of the economics of these players and their championships, probably all three of those players, LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh, are worth far more than the team is allowed to pay them. The cost of this team is not great compared to what they deliver to the owner. But the economics don't change very much if they are runners-up or win or not. So I think that basically the City of Miami has a viable entertainment option for the next couple of years, no matter what happens, which does justify a lot of the cost of, you know, the arena and everything else that goes into having a team here.
So that's a very interesting point. I just want to make sure we're clear on it. It doesn't matter that much if they win the championship or if they stink economically?
Well, stinking isn't good, but they're not going to stink. If they're a very competitive team, then I don't think that the profits swing with the ring. Wow, that rhymes.
Nice.
You know, I think it's more being very good gets you a big chunk of TV revenue from the playoffs.
Henry Abbott with the True Hoop blog at ESPN.com. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
So I got a real kick out of what's been the most popular item this week on the Wall Street Journal's website. I don't know if you saw this, Jeremy. It's a column on our deteriorating grammar at the office.
Oh, yeah, I did see that.
It's not such an issue for our office, I don't think, for people who speak and write for a living. We better get it right. But evidently across the country, employees are coming in with the ability to write a tweet, you know, and condense things in 140 characters, but they can't form a grammatically correct sentence.
Sure.
So, you know, it's Friday today. I thought, let's have a little fun. And, of course, you're a little punchy first thing in the morning. So I put the situation into a limerick. It's kind of a condensed version here of the hypothetical conversation maybe after this column getting around that bosses are having with their employees this week.
All right.
Here we go. There's a problem for you and I, Bob, and I ain't like some grammar snob. Frankly, I could care less, but there's clients to impress, so let's try to talk good on the job. And I should tell you, this aired this morning in one of the early casts, and in the instant it went out over the radio, I got a letter from somebody saying, it's not I could care less, it's I couldn't care less. Get it right. And of course,
the listener is always right, Jeff.
Oh my
the
goodness.
Listener is always
well,
right.
The listener is absolutely correct. The listener just missed the point.
Exactly.
Anyway, most people got it, I'm sure.
Maybe they'll get it this time. Here on the podcast, we have a smarter audience, I guess. I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.